Welcome to Regulatory Ramblings. Our podcast is brought to you by the University of Hong Kong's RegTech Lab, as well as HKU and the Standard Chartered Foundation's FinTech Academy, the Asia Global Institute, and HKU edX's Professional Certificate in FinTech, with support from the university's faculty of law. Our guest today is Mark Steinberg. He's the Rupert and Lillian Radford Professor of Law at Southern Methodist University's Dedman School of Law in Dallas. He's authored approximately 150 law review articles and 40 books. He's also the editor-in-chief of The International Lawyer, as well as the Securities Regulation Law Journal. And he's an advisor to the Journal of Corporation Law. Professor Steinberg is a member of the American Law Institute, and he's lectured at multiple institutions and august bodies around the world, including Hong Kong Securities and Futures Commission and the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Unsurprisingly, his areas of expertise are securities law, business enterprise law, and legal ethics. And amongst the courses he teaches are securities regulation, business enterprise, securities litigation enforcement, lawyering and ethics for the business attorney. And he's also the director of the Corporate Counsel Externship Program at Dedman. Professor Steinberg was an enforcement attorney at the SEC, and after that, he became a special project counsel. In that role, he directly assisted the SEC's general counsel in a wide variety of projects and cases and served as the general counsel's confidential legal advisor. His book, Understanding Securities Law, is an incredibly useful primer in the subject, as I used it during my time as a graduate student in Chicago. It was first published in 1989 and is on its eighth edition, which was published last year. And with that, Professor Steinberg, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me on this podcast. I'm delighted to be on it. Thank you.
It's our honor, sir. Tell us a little bit about yourself. I mean, where are you from originally? Where did you grow up? I mean, what was your background like?
I was born in Detroit, Michigan. That's in the Midwest in the United States. Went to undergraduate at the University of Michigan. After I graduated from the University of Michigan, I went to law school at UCLA. Enjoyed my time there, clerked for a judge in the Ninth Circuit after that, and then received my Master's of Law at Yale. After that, I went to Washington, D.C. I worked as the legislative counsel for a U.S. Senator, Robert P. Griffin from Michigan, and thereafter was on the SEC staff for 4 years, some of the time in the Division of Enforcement as an enforcement attorney, and the other part of the time working as the SEC's general counsel's confidential legal advisor. After that, I went into law school teaching. In the meantime, I've been a consultant to law firms as off counsel. I have also done quite a bit of expert witness practicing through the years.
That's an incredible background to,
thank you,
to enter academia with, rather than just, you know, the straight path of, you know, many academics that I know, which is just law school clerkship, maybe an LLM, and then, you know, then starting to teach.
I think it's very important for a professor who teaches a specialized field like securities law, corporate law, perhaps environmental law, antitrust law, to have a practical skill set before he or she commences as a professor. I think it brings a much more diverse perspective, a much more encompassing viewpoint in the classroom.
I'm intrigued that you express it as such, sir, because where I went to graduate school, okay, both the JD and the LLM students had the option of taking the securities regulation course either during the day or during the evenings. Now, during the evenings, obviously, it was more catered to the international students. But the difference was, if it was during the day, you ended up getting most faculty members, and in the evenings you would get, you know, an adjunct who would typically be a practitioner. The difference in approach was staggering. The academics would teach the same subject, but they would fixate on the gray areas of the law, the 2 or 1% or 5% that was arcane, that wasn't decided, even though much of the law is pretty much established. Whereas with the practitioners, it was, okay, bare bones, when you leave this course, we want you to leave with 20 concepts in your head. that'll probably come up the most in practice. And again, it was the difference was fundamental. But you could argue it either way. You could say, because securities regulation is such a core doctrinal foundational course for anyone wanting to study anything in the area of financial regulation, it should be taught by an academic. But frankly, I mean, it was a much, I found it was a much more enriching approach to have it taught by a practitioner, because again, the focus was on what's practical.
My view is that an academician with practitioner experience is the very best, because it's looked at from both a theoretical and a practical perspective, and also with the recognition of policy and of counseling a client in an appropriate manner.
Sometimes I feel that the academicians, they'll go through cases, but they'll fixate too much on the cases. And the case law approach, okay, going through it chronologically, you're seeing how the law developed. But sometimes if you just fixate on the case law approach is too fragmented. Whereas I found with the practitioners, it was, okay, these are the key rules in this area. And even though they would assign the cases, they would only talk about them to the extent that they were important, or okay, this rule comes from this case. That approach seemed to resonate better with most students. I mean, and there are certain core cardinal chestnut cases that you have to mention. Like, it would be weird not to mention SEC versus Howey, for example.
It would be weird, yes.
So it takes a particular type to go to law school. I mean, I know for myself, there was enough truth in the stereotype when I was going to school that a lot of the people who went to law school wanted to avoid math, and then lo and behold, they took the bar exam and they would have to do some degree of number crunching. Increasingly in recent years, I mean, really since the 80s, there's a sense too many people are going to law school. That Derek Bok, the former president of Harvard, and former dean of the Harvard Law School, even said at a commencement speech once that all endeavors, all fields need people of talent. Not everyone needs to go to law school. Justice Scalia was interviewed once on C-SPAN in 1986 before he was appointed to the DC Circuit by President Reagan, said much the same, that too many people thought going to law school they'd be able to change the world. And there are many other ways to change the world. Norman Cantor, in his book, Imagining the Law, he was a legal historian at NYU, he since passed, said in one of his books around about the time of the millennium that, for the longest time, the belief was going to law school enabled people of average intelligence a comfortable, reasonably comfortable middle class or upper middle class existence, whereas not everyone can be an accountant, not everyone can be a lawyer or a doctor. I mean, not everyone can be a doctor or an accountant or an architect or a scientist or an engineer. With all of that said, what compelled you to go to law school, and when did you realize a career in legal academia was for you?
I thought it was a process of elimination myself. I mean, after all, I was 22 years old, and not too many individuals at 22 know exactly what they want to do. So I was going to go to medical school, and then I took a couple of chemistry classes, and that took care of that. And then I was a history major and really enjoyed that, and thought about being a history professor. But when I really thought about teaching the same subject matter over and over and over again, and also with the job market and how history professors get paid, I figured out I could land up anywhere in the middle of nowhere, with not being paid very much, teaching the same subject over and over again. So I eliminated that. A number of my friends were going to law school. I looked around. I thought that I can go to law school, get a degree, hopefully enjoy practicing law, but certainly it is a credential that should serve me well through my career. And once I started in law school, then I thought I was going to be practicing law. That was my focus. And it just so happened that the best thing that I do intellectually is write. For whatever reason, I can sit down and write an article or write a book and do it very expeditiously, and I like to think do it rather well. And that came through very quickly. I was able to write, for example, six papers my third year in law school, which were published by law reviews. And these were not in securities law at all. So I thought about what to do. Fortunately, I got a clerkship in the Ninth Circuit, which is a very difficult clerkship to get. And as I thought about it, I figured, well, why don't I get a master's of law and go to Yale? Fortunately, I got a fellowship there. And from there, I still didn't know what I wanted to do. I thought I wanted to teach, but I thought it was very important that I get some practical skills before I would start teaching. And that's how I ended up going to Washington, working for a U.S. senator, and then ultimately with the SEC. After working with the SEC, my goal was I knew that I wanted to be an academician, so I focused my career on that. But also from the standpoint of not only being an academician, but also being able to consult and being an expert witness and being on the playing field rather than only a spectator. That's important to me, that although when these cases come up, I may not be trying the case, as an expert witness, I am on the playing field. I am taking part in the process, which is very different than simply being an academic and that only, in which you're basically watching the festivities or the game, so to speak, from as a spectator, from the audience, and then basically writing about it.
Oh,
So I,
totally. Yeah.
yeah, so I think I'm fortunate in being able to combine what I do best and also what I really enjoy doing as well. And of course, I really love interfacing with the students. It enables me to think that I'm a lot younger than I am. And that's, I think, a good thing for me.
I agree. I think there is something that keeps one certainly young in their thinking, exposed to newer and cutting-edge ideas and alternate views of thinking by merely being on that university campus. So there's something about that experience that exposes you to that for sure. And you've been very prolific, so clearly that's benefited your writing. What was it about financial law, in particular securities regulation? Because I know for me, it was Enron. At that time, I was interested in international law and IP. And then I realized, okay, financial law and securities reg and corporate governance matters. It affects everything.
Well, I could say that I was really focused on securities law as I began law school as an undergraduate, but my story is very different. In a way, it may be very helpful to those listening who really don't know what they want to do, what type of law they want to practice. And that is, I had written on all sorts of subjects of the law prior to working at the SEC. In other words, I wrote articles on criminal law, family law, constitutional law, legal ethics, even admiralty law. If I found a subject I wanted to write on, I simply learned the subject a bit better and wrote on it. I never took securities regulation in law school. I took the basic corporation law course. I thought it was okay. I wasn't enthralled with it. And what happened was that it was time for me to leave Capitol Hill working for a senator. I figured I had worked for him for a year and a half, and it was a wonderful experience. It was like it was the time before C-SPAN, but if one watches C-SPAN, I would be basically the aide sitting next to the senator at committee meetings and on the floor of the Senate. So for a 26-year-old, that was just an incredibly exciting job. But I also saw on Capitol Hill that no one basically is his or her own boss. They're always beholden to the member. They could be fired at the whim of a member. That there is very little professional development for one's own self. And that although it was a great experience for a year and a half, that I needed to get out. I also knew I wanted to teach, and I knew I wanted to teach a specialized course, specialized type area. And what happened at the time was that President Carter was president, and there was a hiring freeze. So I got interviews at, for example, the Antitrust Department, at the Justice Department, and at the Federal Trade Commission, at the Treasury Department, at the Environmental Protection Agency. And they basically said to me, you have an interesting resume, but there's a hiring freeze. And when the hiring freeze is lifted, come on back and we'll consider you. And then for whatever reason, my mentor, Stanley Sporkin, who had such a successful career, Judge Sporkin basically was the director of enforcement at the SEC during the questionable payments era when the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act was passed. He then became general counsel of the Central Intelligence Agency. So going from a regime of disclosure to a regime of non-disclosure, that was his career. And then he was appointed to the federal bench as a district court judge by President Reagan, as I recall, and served as a federal judge for many years. But in any event, for whatever reason, he came across my resume and liked my resume for the reason that I had written a lot. And he called me in for an interview and said to me, you have a job. This is in the enforcement division. And I said, well, I've never taken securities law. And he said, I don't care. You'll learn. And then I said, well, I understand there's a hiring freeze. And he also said then, I don't care. He said, we'll put you on it as temporary right now. And then once the president lifts the freeze, we'll put you on as permanent. And I figured, well, here is a very interesting area of the law. I know nothing about it at the time, but I should be able to learn the area. This is by far the best opportunity that I have. I didn't want to go work for a law firm for two reasons. One is that I was afraid that I'd make so much money, I would never leave, and that would be against my ultimate interest. And the second was I thought it was important that I keep up my writing, my scholarship. And in a law firm, I didn't think that I would have the time to do that. So I did not apply to law firms. So this was the best opportunity I had. So I accepted it. And was one of the best decisions, of course, that I've made in my life, because from there I was able to learn the securities laws and develop this expertise, and really have had a very enjoyable career.
Sounds prudent.
So the story behind this to those students who are listening to this, or even for those attorneys who are out there practicing for a year or two and say, well, I really haven't found what I wanted. I think my response is to keep your thoughts open, to go out and to meet as many people as you can, get involved in as many opportunities as you can, and see what type of situations come your way that may be to your liking.
Talk to me about your time as a regulator. What was it like at the SEC? What were your fondest memories? What was the most rewarding part of your job as a litigator in enforcement? And anything you care to share?
Sure. The enforcement division generally is, of course, the division within the SEC that prosecutes alleged violations of the federal securities laws.
On the civil side?
On the civil side, yes. It is a fascinating experience because basically as an enforcement attorney, you build the case yourself. So in other words, you're able to open an investigation, subpoena documents, take witness testimony, and seek to build a case.
We should point out, just real quickly to our listeners, the criminal infractions get outsourced to the DOJ.
That's right. The Department of Justice does the criminal actions. So we're talking about that there I am, 28 years old at the time. I've had no litigation experience. That, of course, I have people supervising me and working with me, but basically I'm in there taking depositions, building cases, where in a law firm, I would be in the library. But I'm not implying here that I was necessarily good at this. I was better when I left to go to the general counsel's office than when I began. But just imagine, as a 28-year-old lawyer taking, for example, two dozen depositions within a year or two. That would never happen in private practice. And the memory that strikes out the very best in me, which is simply, I tell this to my students, and it's a true story, is that I was in New York with my supervisor, oh, I would say maybe the second or third week on the job. I was going to basically be the second chair in my first deposition. And the person whose deposition was taken was the chief executive officer of a Fortune 500 company. So it
Wow.
was a very important position.
Yeah.
This was before the time of the internet and cell phones and so on. This was around 1980. I was getting ready to go to the deposition, and the phone rings in my room, in my hotel room. And I answered, of course. And my supervisor says, "Mark, I am on the floor. I have thrown out my back. I can't get off the floor. You're going to have to take the deposition." So, of course, I said, "Okay." So I walked in the room. I just remember this like yesterday, you know, some ways. And we're talking about a different era here. So we're talking about the CEO, who looks exactly like a CEO, especially in those days, talking about the pinstripe suit, three-piece suit, the white shirt, the immaculate silk tie, the pocket watch, the handkerchief, right? So he just looked the part of a CEO, grayish hair, probably a man in his late 50s, early 60s, I'd say. And there was the partner from a Wall Street law firm who was defending the deposition, a partner who was maybe in his 50s, I'd say, late 40s, 50s. And there was his maybe 8-year associate who was basically carrying his bags. A young man, I can say young today, who was probably in his late 20s to early 30s. He looked older than his late 20s, so I would say early 30s.
But about your age, but getting very different professional experience.
Right, I was markedly younger than him. I was 28, so he may have had more hair than me. You know, I'm basically bald, but yeah, he was definitely older than me. But in any event, I just walked in, and of course, I didn't tell him that it was my first deposition, and I took the deposition. I don't know how good it really was, but the fact of the matter is that where else can that basically happen? My point here is that you know, all sorts of cases. Another case that is public is that I was one of the enforcement attorneys on, I think still today, the only known case of stock manipulation that was carried on from within prison.
Wow.
And the Washington Post ran a front page story on this case. And basically, this individual was an individual, his name, James Corr. Basically was in prison for some sort of white collar offense at Eglin Air Force Base prison in Florida. It's a low security prison, and
Okay.
his fellow inmates were basically convicts who had been convicted of peddling marijuana, those types of drugs, and they're sent to a low security prison. Anyway, Mr. Corr joined the prison's Toastmasters Club, and he touted this stock called CHB Food Stock, claiming that General Foods was going to take over CHB Foods because CHB Foods was one of the last independent canneries of tuna in the country, and that General Foods was primed to take it over.
Okay.
What happened was that purchases were made of CHB Food Stock by several of the inmates. And the rumor spread throughout the country, and the stock ran from 7 to 17. In other words, the stock before this broke was around $7 per share. And through these rumors spreading that General Foods was going to take the company over, which were false, the stock went up as high as 17. At that time, the stock was suspended from trading. The SEC stepped in, and the stock went down to its pre-rumor levels. And I investigated that case, actually going into going into prisons, taking depositions, going around the country. And some of it was so sad. And that is, I remember a gentleman walking in from North Carolina who had been taken in by these rumors, and he had invested all of his daughter's college savings that he
Wow.
was going to send her to college in the stock. And of course, he lost a good deal of money. So there were a lot of innocent victims who got taken in on this rumor. And I was one of a number of attorneys who investigated this case. Mr. Kaur was convicted. He was sued by the SEC and also prosecuted by the Department of Justice and went back to prison.
Well, never, I guess never underestimate the enterprising nature of criminals. They will operate from wherever the milieu is. Even Al Capone ran his enterprise for a time from prison.
Another point that I learned was, never have your client, of course, this would never happen with your knowledge, but one must warn, as an attorney, must warn the client continuously not to lie to the government. Because a number of times people would come in, they would look at individuals like me who are much younger than them, have an alibi they were able to develop for months, and simply lie. And there is, I think, no quicker way for a criminal referral from the SEC or probably any other regulator to the Department of Justice than a false statements type of situation. And the Department of Justice will pursue those because, after all, there's no need to prove the underlying violation. All that needs to be proven is the person deliberately lied. And of course, that's a felony conviction.
Yeah.
And, I was an expert witness for Martha Stewart in her criminal trial, in which she was convicted. And I also saw an individual recant. And in other words, what do I recommend if you find out after your client has lied or that person becomes your client after the situation is to promptly get your client into that government regulator and recant his or her testimony. And also to recant in a very remorseful way, to bring up one's family if one does have a family, especially children, and also to cry might be helpful as well, because after all, we're talking about attorneys being here, being human beings after all, and if a person comes in and recants and talks about his or her children. And is very remorseful and shed some tears, that may help in the determination whether to make the referral to the Justice Department.
That's a fair point because when the feds are coming to see you, they already have the goods. They already know what the facts are.
There are situations, though, where there is a group of targets, and the government is trying to get the goods. And they all agree that they will invoke their right to self-incrimination and not testify. And that can be hard to develop a case when all the key targets and those who know the facts refuse to speak. And I've seen cases actually fended off that way, where the government simply cannot basically break that barrier and get the evidence that it needs in order to pursue the case.
I mean, you clearly learned a lot as a regulator. And if we take a step back and look at things from a more macro perspective, I mean, people have long said that the U.S. capital markets are the envy of the world due to their depth of liquidity. But I think that the soundness of what a legal and regulatory system also matters. Rules and frameworks matter. And to that end, what do you think America's regulatory apparatus has done to contribute to its market success?
Well, we don't live in a perfect world,
No.
and that's a profound statement, I know. So everything has to be relative, and there's much wrong with the U.S. system. When I visited Hong Kong last month, actually, I spoke about my book, Rethinking Securities Law, which looks at the U.S. system. It talks about what the law is, what is wrong with the law, and how the law should be corrected. I'm proud to say that the book was awarded the best law book in the United States for the year 2021. It's published by Oxford University Press. So there's a lot that's wrong with the US markets. What gives it vitality, I think, is a very active trading markets we have with the New York Exchange and the NASDAQ. I think we have a very sound, for the most part, not to say that it's perfect, self-regulatory organizations. I think FINRA does a very nice job overall as far as its role as a self-regulatory organization. And then we have the SEC that, although that certainly has its problems, and I have been very critical, nonetheless, the SEC, through its Division of Corporation Finance, with the disclosure process, with the mutual funds, through the Investment Management Division, with the integrity of the markets themselves, the Division of Market Regulation, and then, of course, the Division of Enforcement. And on top of all that, we also have the Office of the General Counsel, which is the legal expert to the commission, where the attorneys in that office know the securities laws on an expert level. I think when we combine all these variables along with a fairly vibrant disclosure framework and a situation where there is also active litigation, not only by the SEC, but also by the private bar, that this induces a market that is fairly efficient and fair. So that as compared to other markets, I think that's why the US markets have reached the success that they have. But still, my position is that there is a lot wrong with the US markets, as we've seen at various points of time. For example, rarely do we see high-level officers or directors of large publicly held companies sued even civilly by the SEC, unless they engage in insider trading. If the SEC did that, would that impair companies from going public? And that also raises a whole nother issue, as I'm just going off on a little bit of a tangent. And that is, with all this regulation that's happening, the inducement is that for these unicorns to stay private, these companies that are valued at $1 billion and more, that there are more and more of these unicorns that see that what's required of them if they do go public, and they elect to stay private by having a series of private offerings, so that today we have, I believe, well over 1,000 companies in the US that have over $1 billion valuation that are privately held. Don't hold me to that number. That's just what I recall. But we're talking about many, many companies. So, for example, with the current chairman's focus on ESG disclosure, this has been a very big focus of the chairman. What is that going to do, in my view? I'm not against ESG disclosure, don't get me wrong. But this is not a core issue that the SEC should pursue. What's going to happen is what's happened with the management compensation. You go look at the proxy statement or the 10-K, the annual report, if it's in there, you have 30, 40 pages of disclosure where an ordinary investor will not read that for sure. And even if he or she reads it, they won't remember what they read. With the ESG disclosure, we're going to have another 30 pages of disclosure. So what we have today in the US markets is information overload, which deters these companies that are private from going public. Moreover, it saddles these publicly held companies, I believe, with unnecessary disclosure, to the degree that it's cost prohibitive, and it does not enhance informed investor decision making.
I mean, it's really a sensory overload. It's aiming a fire hose at a teacup, and it undermines the stated goal of plain English.
And that's one of the recommendations I make in this book, Rethinking Securities Law, and that is that the SEC require that a summary of the disclosure document be provided in any type of filing that is of substance with the commission. For example, an annual report, a registration statement, a quarterly report, that there be, for example, a summary not to exceed 10 or 15 pages in which the corporation, the issuer, or the registrant summarizes the information that is in that document, which would, of course, enable ordinary investors to review that information and have a good idea of the key facts and circumstances relating to the company. And I would be okay with providing a safe harbor from liability unless there's intent to defraud. Because the response is, well, how can we include everything in the summary that's going to go into a 150-page document? Of course, items have got to be omitted. Well, my response is that the SEC could set out a rule that certain items must be included. Otherwise, it's a free writing document that the company can put in whatever information it wants, and that it will only incur liability if it acts with intentional misconduct or reckless misconduct.
Something else that always struck me was, you know, I was of two minds in the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act of 1995, and, you know, what ultimately ended up happening to it. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I definitely have some thoughts on it. Thank you for asking. This is bizarre legislation, because when you think about it, what we had was we had a Democratic president, President Clinton. We had, as I recall, one of the houses of Congress, I think it was the Senate, that was controlled by the Democrats. I believe the House of Representatives was controlled by the Republicans.
Right.
And the Democrats are generally more in vogue for investor protection and so on. The Republicans are generally thought of more with respect to capital raising.
Yeah.
This does not necessarily always apply, as we see with the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. And what we had was basically the Congress being upset at the number of securities lawsuits being brought, believing that the plaintiffs' lawyers were being overly fixatious in their litigation practices, and through the work of the business organizations, like the Business Roundtable, for example, they're able to induce Congress to enact such friendly, pro-defendant legislation as I've ever seen. For example, if a company makes a forward-looking statement, such as projecting its earnings, and we're talking about a reporting company here, so a company that's already listed on a stock exchange.
Right, the bespeaks caution doctrine.
Yes, if a company makes forward-looking statements and accompanies that by meaningful cautionary statements, the bespeaks caution doctrine, then that forward-looking statement is not actionable as a matter of law, even if the company acted with fraud, that the mens rea requirement is irrelevant. Now, I don't know how you can get a more pro-defendant type of legislation than that. And needless to say, that's not good public policy.
Yeah.
Moreover, now, the plaintiffs have got to plead fraud in a case involving Section 10B, the main anti-fraud provision, with greater particularity than would normally be required under other statutes.
Of the 34 Security Exchange Act.
Yes,
right?
Yes. This is what the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act does, is that it requires fraud to be pled with even greater particularity. But what makes this particularly difficult is that no discovery is permitted, either documentary discovery or witness testimony, until and unless a motion to dismiss is fended off.
Wow.
So that means that the plaintiff's firms have got to allege fraud without being afforded no discovery whatsoever. So what the firms have to rely upon are government investigations, news sources, and many of them hire private investigators who go into corporations to try to uncover fraud that is being engaged in, and basically be informed by current and former employees of that company.
But that's a very slanted battlefield. I mean, and then naturally they're going to engage in fishing expeditions.
Right. But yet note that these lawyers are paid, of course, in a contingency fee basis.
Yeah.
So that means that they file these cases and the cases are dismissed, they receive no fee. So that means the cases that are filed, the plaintiff's lawyers have got to feel that they've got a fairly good chance of fending off the motion to dismiss, because they're not going to get paid if they are not able to. So they're literally devoting hundreds of hours to draft these complaints. And in a given year, roughly 40 to 50% of these complaints are dismissed at the motion to dismiss stage. So that means basically half or a little more than half survive each year because of this very challenging hurdle of pleading fraud with particularity without being afforded any discovery. It's another example of the very pro-defendant focus of this legislation. So the law changes sometimes to make it unduly difficult for companies. On the other hand, then there are other times where the law is far too relaxed with respect to that situation.
And then we come to the 2002 Sarbanes-Oxley Act, and I guess the Bush administration had to take action.
Right. So what happened there was, here we have a conservative president being elected, President George W. Bush, very much a pro-business president, a conservative president with a conservative Congress. And one would think that this would be the last Congress which would pass the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. But as we know, we had WorldCom, we had Global Crossings, we had Enron, we had Adelphia, just one after another of these massive frauds. And when WorldCom, the last one, was hit with the magnitude that it did, Congress felt that it was forced to take action.
It's interesting that, come 1980, Reagan gets in and his position is government is the problem, right? And then you have Bush coming in 2 decades later, Bush 43, saying all too often people in my party have confused a hatred of big government with a hatred of government itself. And he wanted to point out that that wasn't the two weren't necessarily the same, as Pat Buchanan pointed out, that basically the only thing wrong with the house that liberalism built, i.e., the expansion of the federal government under FDR, was that liberals were running the show. If we conservatives were running the show, we could make it run more effectively.
Well, I like to think of the position of my mentor, Stan Sporkin. Jed Sporkin was a lifelong Republican. He was fairly conservative. And the senator I worked for, Bob Griffin from Michigan, a Republican, viewed as a moderate in those times. Today he would, in fact, he was viewed more as a conservative in those days. Today he would definitely be viewed as a moderate, not as a conservative. But what both these individuals believed was that in order for the market to be fair, there had to be vigorous enforcement. If there were not vigorous enforcement, then of course the markets would be rigged. So, of course, if you believe in capitalism, if you believe in the integrity of the marketplace, if you want to induce investor participation, then what you've got to have is fairness and integrity in the marketplace. And you only have that if you have sufficiently active enforcement.
Oh, for sure. And if you think about the crash of 87, and then you think about what was it, the that banking scandal late Senator McCain was involved in.
The savings and loan crisis.
Yeah, exactly. And it was a Republican that went after them then. The Republicans of Eisenhower's era were by no means Ayn Rand libertarians, that they weren't saying regulation had no place, as opposed to today.
Yes, it's a very different viewpoint today with the Republican standpoint. In fact, the judge that I clerked for, Judge Stanley Barnes of the Ninth Circuit, he was Assistant Attorney General of the Antitrust Division under the Eisenhower administration. Again, that's an example of he is definitely a conservative judge who also believed that when circumstances were appropriate, that vigorous enforcement was necessary.
Because the argument on the other side right now is Republicans don't understand regulation, that they want to deregulate everything back to the Stone Age. And maybe that's true for a certain mutant variant species of the party that seems to reign today. But there's something to be said for old school conservative values that stress moderation and prudence. That seems to be gone now. Just as not all libertarians once upon a time cared much for Ayn Rand's views.
Well, I think we can also talk about the Democrats here and the situation with the commission. I mean, here we have the SEC commission with a Democratic chair. And under President Obama, there's also a Democratic chair. And let's just talk about the Obama administration for a moment. The financial crisis hit, in those ensuing years, President Obama was president. Chair White was the SEC chair of the commission. There was only one case that I'm aware of where the SEC brought an enforcement action against a high-level executive of one of these publicly held companies. In other words, the SEC sued Bank of America $16 billion without naming any high-level insider in an enforcement action. The commission levied millions, hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars in fines against publicly held companies, of which if you and I were shareholders, we're paying for that, given the diminution in the value of that company after payment of that fine, and yet refuses to name high-level insiders. And this has continued during this current administration under this current chair. Even though we have a Democratic administration, the fact of the matter is that directors and officers of high level of Fortune 500, Fortune 1000 companies are not being sued by the SEC when their companies engage in misconduct. That the SEC does not have the fortitude to name these insiders. And this is under a Democratic administration.
Well, frankly, I wasn't that surprised when I saw Obama staffed his administration with Clinton-era retreads. And as for President Biden, he certainly believes in the neoliberal worldview, and he's a, you know, the he's of the slightly right of center Democratic Leadership Council type senators, you know, Hillary Clinton, Joe Lieberman, John Kerry certainly fit that mold.
Let me raise one other point, if I may. I think
Sure.
this really reinforces my point very nicely. And that is there's a provision under the U.S. federal securities laws called the control person provision. The control person provision says that if there's a primary violation, the person who is a control person, there may be far more than one in a particular corporation, is equally as liable unless the control person is able to establish good faith. So, in other words, there's a primary violation. Let's assume a company commits a primary violation. It files a misleading annual report and does so allegedly with fraud. The corporation is liable. But of course, the chief executive officer and the chair of the board of directors, each of those individuals is a control person. Those persons can be sued under a separate provision under the federal securities laws called the control person, whereby once a claim is made against a primary participant, the control person must affirmatively show the defense of good faith. This provision is used in private securities class actions by the plaintiffs bar in the United States with regularity. In other words, I wouldn't say it's unusual not to see a control person claim, but I would say I'd be surprised if in at least 85 to 90% of the securities class actions, the plaintiffs allege a control person claim against, for example, the chief executive officer. Do you know how many times the SEC has used the control person provision in this situation? In the last, as far as I know, 30, 40 years? One time, once. And that was about 6 years ago after I wrote a law review article on it. I don't know if my law review article had anything to do with it, but if it did, then it only served its purpose on one occasion, and during a Democratic chair again, the SEC has refused to use a statutory provision which Congress expressly gave the SEC to use against high-level officers. Absolutely, the commission lacks the fortitude to bring these cases against these high-level individuals. And of course, I find that totally unacceptable.
You're not saying anything others haven't said, and certainly Dodd-Frank was disappointing. And if we're talking about the need for systemic reform, yet the financial world went after it hammer and tongue, you know, subjecting it to judicial challenge and, you know, having portions rewritten through their lobbyists. Is Wall Street capable of regulating itself or no? Because some would say self-regulation means no regulation.
I would say absolutely not. I don't think a voluntary disclosure framework would work. I don't think with self-regulation, I would think there'd be far more insider trading. I would think there'd be far more short selling. I think there are far more rumors. I think that that disclosure of unfavorable information would not be as willingly made by companies. I think that self-regulation is an unacceptable situation, at least in the United States, under the cultural climate that exists. And I don't think there's any talk about moving back there, but note here that there is a form of self-regulation that is existing. And of course, that's in the private capital markets, where you have accredited investors investing in these unicorns, companies that have a $1 billion valuation, where basically what you have at work is solely the anti-fraud provisions. So yes, it's not totally self-regulation from the standpoint that you do have fraud regulation by the states and by the SEC and by private parties. But as far as requiring disclosure information, that is deemed to be a situation that is one of negotiation between investors and the issuer. And there are different views whether that's working or not. And a recent empirical study has shown that there is not nearly the amount of disclosure in those markets than there is in the publicly held company markets, where these companies must make these disclosures. Whether sufficient information is being brought, that's an answer that the market really does not know. I think we'll only find the answer if and when we have adversity, that we have a downturn in the economy, we have a massive fraud, those types of situations that we've seen before.
Which brings me to my next query, which is, I mean, why the U.S. is so reactionary? It seems like after every financial scandal, there's a call for more reform or regulation, a willingness to enforce, rather than a willingness to enforce existing securities laws. So after the crash of 29, you had the 33-34 Act, Glass-Steagall, Enron, WorldCom, Sarbanes-Oxley, Dodd-Frank after the subprime crisis. Seems to me overlaying rules upon rules makes the U.S. regulatory system complex and unwieldy. I mean, there's a quote that's attributed to Reagan, which is apparently when he came into office in 1980, he said, "What a country, we've got 10 million laws to enforce 10 commandments." And I imagine the federal bureaucracy has grown substantially since then. One of my libertarian friends told me that, by the way. So what do you think?
Well, things have definitely become more complex, and this is part of the information overload. And we're seeing just more and more and more. It makes me recall when I first joined the SEC that I was able to sit down for an afternoon. Maybe I'm exaggerating, but let's suppose I was able to spend 8 hours a week, and I was able to read every single court decision on securities laws and every single law review article that I thought worth reading in those 8 hours, every single week. And I remember when I began writing on securities laws, there were very few articles that covered the field. So I had subjects to write on wide open, just a host of different issues that I was able to write on and be able to place them into very good reviews. Today, the law is far more complex, far more costly, and we have information overload. And I think it is a deterrent from entering the U.S. markets. It's a deterrent of these privately held companies of going public, and those companies that are already publicly held that really have no other choice, that's simply viewed as basically a cost of doing business. Now, one nice thing of this that from an attorney standpoint is that more and more of these corporations are taking this work in-house and hiring in-house counsel to do their securities filings, with the feeling that this saves a whole lot more money, that we're far better off hiring a good attorneys who are only focused on our company, and they will deal with this situation in this fashion. And only if we have a challenging disclosure question will we consult with outside counsel. We may have outside counsel review the document, but basically the document is drafted in-house. Well, speaking as a law professor at SMU, we have the Corporate Extern Program. I believe it's the largest program in the country. Last fall, we sent 120 students into Dallas-based and other cities by virtually to be externs in legal departments of corporations. These students work 8 hours a week. They have a real good experience, and they see the value of being in-house counsel. Well, what this enables this what this has done is that it's opened up a whole new opportunity for securities lawyers who want to avoid the billable hours, who want to avoid the client development stress of big firm practice, to go in-house and practice sophisticated securities law with a much better, at least in many companies, a much better style of living. So, I mean, this is the situation we're in, and you raise a very good point, and things are not going to get better. I mean, if the Republicans get in, what we'll have is fewer rules. But the fact that w whether rules are going to be rescinded, that's unlikely. But with all these rules taking place, the SEC missed a golden opportunity in the aftermath of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. And what I mean by that is the following, is that when before the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, what is required in the US for a publicly held company is a quarterly report 3 times a year, and then the annual report the fourth quarter. There's also something called a current report called an 8K. Prior to the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, that current report only had 5 items that were very, very material, such as the resignation of the accountant, the company entering into bankruptcy. I don't recall the other three off the top of my head, but there were those types of, I think it was resignation of a director.
Big earth-shattering events.
Well, in the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, Congress directed the SEC to adopt a rapid and current reporting framework. In other developed markets in the world, the European Union, for example, Australia is another example, and I believe Hong Kong as well, you can correct me on this if I'm mistaken, is if information is material, it must be promptly disclosed. That is not the law in the United States. What the SEC did was expand the 8K. So in other words, the 8K had a list of 5 items. Now the 8K has a list of, for example, 20 items. If that event does not fall into one of those 20 items, then no disclosure needs to be promptly made, even though that situation is very material. So the result is that we have all these rules and regulations that require disclosure information, much of which is not material in the least bit. Well, we don't have any type of mandate in the United States requiring that companies promptly disclose, for example, within 24 hours or within next opening of the next day's trading on ex an exchange of information that they know is material. And that's another situation that is utterly unacceptable. And yet nothing is being done about this. I discussed this at length in my book, Rethinking Securities Law, just how unacceptable this situation is.
I agree from a investor protection and market openness and confidence standpoint that the definition of what's material needs to be more expansive, because you can't ahead of time envisage everything that is material.
Right. Well, what the commission is saying is that even if it is material, there's no duty to disclose it if it's not within those 20 items. And the company has not previously spoken on the issue. So to be more precise, if the company has not spoken on the subject matter, and if the situation is not called for by one of those 20 items, then no disclosure need promptly be made pursuant to the 8K, even though that information is clearly material and management and the board of directors know that it is material.
Yeah, I mean that's blatantly anti-consumer, and that's not the openness and transparency which we've come to associate with the US. But again, even the best systems can regress.
But for example, let me give a concrete example. So if the listeners are out there who will say, well, that's fine from academic level, but let's provide a concrete example. Let's suppose that today is January 4th, that is today, and let's suppose that the company has a contract with a major customer that accounts for over 10% of the company's revenues. That contract is on a year-to-year basis, starting on July 1st of each year, ending on June 30th. Today, the company receives a letter from the customer notifying the company that coming this June 30th, the customer will not be renewing the contract. So that customer who provided more than 10% of the company's revenues has informed the company that come about 6 months from now, there's not going to be a new contract. That's material, clearly material. It does not have to be disclosed pursuant to the 8K. It would not have to be disclosed until the filing of the next 10-Q. The quarter ends on March 31st. The 10-Q, if I recall, is due around May 4th. So that means this information can be embargoed by the company until the first week of May, so that the securities markets are utterly ignorant of this very material fact, in which there's no justifiable business reason for not disclosing. So my recommendation is that when companies are aware of material information, the board knows, management knows that it's material, it must be promptly disclosed unless there's a justifiable business reason, such as engaging in merger negotiations that need secrecy, that would justify non-disclosure at that time.
Clearly, there's a difference between what's legal and what's ethical. What you're advocating is they go beyond the obligations that are legally prescribed for them.
Well, what I'm advocating is for the view adopted in the EU, in Australia, in Hong Kong. But note what happens in the US, though, is that yes, many of these laws are more strict than the US, but the US has vigorous enforcement
Of course.
compared to many other jurisdictions. So although the law may be present in other jurisdictions that is stricter, the likelihood and frequency of enforcement is far less.
Well, they put in the resources. That makes a, if you're willing to deploy the resources, that shows the political will.
But also there is also the mindset of the commission, the SEC, being having the wherewithal, the fortitude to bring these actions, which in some cases the commission has done so, in other cases the commission has been very disappointing.
I would also add that the willingness and the freedom to bring those actions free of political control.
Right. Well, the SEC is supposed to be an agency.
Yeah, and in a lot of parts of the world, they may have, glistening, immaculate rules on the books, but it doesn't pan out that way, because certainly in emerging markets, because of political control.
Yes.
I want to come to the topic of legal ethics, which is of interest to you. I mean, when I was in school, it was called professional responsibility, but I think this came about in the aftermath of Watergate. And it's not, maybe it's not a coincidence that the two presidents who have gotten into trouble with the law were Nixon and Clinton, both lawyers themselves.
A third president as well right now.
I think he'll always have an asterisk next to his name. But it seems to me that my view's always been, you can't maybe teach legal ethics. Maybe you can inculcate the values that lead to legal ethics, but can you really teach legal ethics?
I think what one can do is, and I teach this course called Lawyering and Ethics for the Business Attorney. Lawyering and Ethics for the Business Attorney. I have a textbook on it that's really based upon scenarios and so on. I think education plays a huge role for individuals to understand the situations that arise and what they are expected to do when those situations do occur. So I think they are very helpful from that standpoint, from an educational type view of what can be done, what cannot be done, and then of consequences not only to their clients, but to themselves if they don't behave properly. In other words, one of the greatest incentives of individuals performing in an ethical manner are the consequences if one does not do so. And basically engages in unethical behavior. And that's a strong inducement towards compelling one to perform in an ethical way.
I bring it up because you're of a generation where you remember that for much of the 20th century, you had what, 21 canons of professional conduct that governed the profession before the ABA's model rules of professional conduct, which were adopted pretty much uniformly across by all the states. And the difference, it seemed to me, was there was a rule for everything, and that got overwhelming. Whereas when you had the canons of professional conduct, people maybe didn't sue as much for malpractice. But from the practitioners I've spoken to, certainly the older practitioners, they prefer the canons of professional conduct.
Well, I think the canons of professional conduct go bef way before the model rules. You had the code of professional discipline, I think it was called, before the model rules, which did set out rules, and then they also contained basically comments that were more ethical than required, but. My opinion is
But it was a lot more 19, it seemed like it was more a product of the 19th century, gentleman's agreement, more genteel, we're gentlemen, we'll figure it out, we'll sort it out between ourselves.
I agree with you. What has changed also, though, is the complexity of the law, the huge law firms that we have. I mean, after all, we're talking about law firms in Hong Kong. They have 20, 30 different offices. Imagine Baker and McKenzie. They no doubt has a Hong Kong office. I mean, how many offices do they have around the world? And of course, they're viewed as one firm, and any conflict issue that arises, whether it's in Hong Kong or Bangkok or London or in Chicago, they've got to deal with as if they're a two-person firm. And the
Yeah,
question is,
because it's imputed that within the firm, across offices, across jurisdictions, they share information.
right. And so the confidence and secrets apply and so on. There has been some relaxation with screening principles, but I think that the law has become far more complex. The specialties have become far more complex. The demands on attorneys have become, I think, more rigorous. That I think that the model rules play an important role in helping ethical attorney conduct to come about.
As a legal academician, I'm curious about legal pedagogy. The US has a four-tier structure when it comes to its law schools, and I'll wholeheartedly admit I got my JD at a four-tier law school, which would end up, by the time I graduated, it was a third-tier law school. I got my LLM from a second-tier law school. Do the tiers make sense? Because too many people fixate on the US News and World Report rankings, and some say that that doesn't fully convey the quality of law school. It's more about did you meet certain requirements and devote resources and areas that the ABA wanted you to? And if so, then you score well and you rank highly.
Well, that's a good question, and one I've given a good deal of thought about. Not so much from the chair of law schools, but if there's students out there from a student standpoint, and that is, there are always going to be institutions that are ranked higher than others. That's simply a fact of life. Sometimes it's fair, sometimes it's unfair, but that's the situation. But I've seen a very encouraging development, and that is that in the old days, I'm talking about 20, 30, 40 years ago, it would be relatively rare for you to see a partner who's 10, 12 years out from rephrasing from a third-tier school, for example, become a partner at a major firm.
And that's changed.
That has changed. That has changed. So my point is that for those students who are listening, if you're at the top of the class, of course you're going to get a position with one of those firms. But if you're not at the top of the class, what you've got to do is develop different skill sets, which you're particularly good at, which will be attractive to those firms. It may be writing. It may be advocacy. It may be getting involved in bar activities, maybe going to a firm and then working your way up from that firm to another firm, getting good litigation experience, where you will find yourself a person that these firms will be interested in. And from what I can see now is that 10 years out of law school, even in these big firms, I'm sure there are some exceptions on Wall Street, for example, no one really cares about the grades. The question is what type of lawyer are you? How good are you? What are your client base? What kind of clients do you have? Are you collegial? Do you get along with others? How do you interface with clients? It's not what you received in torts or criminal law or constitutional law, where you graduated from your class. So I think that going to a first-year law school and or graduating very high in the class, of course, those are great accomplishments. They are very helpful for getting that first job, and maybe helpful for getting a second or third job. But my point here is that if one's going to really make a career and be successful, no matter where one goes to school, one has got to develop one's skill set that he or she is particularly good at and be able to take advantage of that. And of course, what are huge, of course, assets like diligence, like good judgment. Good judgment is one of the most unsaid type of assets that is said with the law. That if a lawyer has good judgment and can quickly survey a situation and give good advice, that's going to matter a lot. And then, of course, being able to develop clients. I have many, I've taught for a long time. I have many, many students who graduate in the middle of the class who now have outstanding legal practices, who have done exceptionally well, and have done much better than a number of students who have graduated at the top of the class.
Some people are late bloomers. I mean, so many things come to mind when I hear you say that. That 5 years into practice, people have said to me that the GPA doesn't matter. I got my LM in Chicago, and it was a perfect town because you had at the top of the pack you had Northwestern and U of C. Somewhere in the middle you had DePaul, you had Loyola, you had Kent, my alma mater, and then at the bottom you had John Marshall. Now, one of my mentors, brilliant man, he went to Yale. I mean, it's not an issue for you. You got Mark, you got your credentials at all upper echelon institutions. But my mentor, he got his undergraduate degree at Yale. So they think he's smart because of where he went to undergrad. But then he got his law degree from John Marshall. Now, within the town, within the city, John Marshall was regarded as a good working man's law school. And many have even said, I would rather hire a street fighter than a genteel, effete intellectual from one of the higher ranked, quasi, well, not Ivy League, but of that caliber, top 14 law schools, of which Northwestern and University of Chicago are on that list. And I recall around about April of 2002, John Marshall's deal with the University of Chicago to buy them out fell through. But let's be honest, people do judge you. The grading is harsher from what I've seen at the lower ranked institutions, which brings up the topic of grade inflation at higher ranked schools, not just at undergrad, but at graduate school level. The grading is more generous at the top schools. So then you've got the prestige of going to a top school, higher GPA, easier to get certainly you get your first job or get the interview. If the grading's tougher at the lower ranked schools, they're like, it puts them at a disadvantage. But I mean, something Professor Arner and one of my other mentors, Sung Jun Cho at Chicago Kent, discussed was that faculty know that it's about the same percentage of students at all schools that are A grade students, 10 to 15%, the top 10 to 15%. The question is, how bad are the bottom 20% at Harvard versus a mid-tier school versus a lower-ranked school? What are your thoughts?
My thoughts are, at the very top of the class, wherever I've been, the students have been exceptionally good. Generally, at the bottom of the class, there are students who should have never been admitted, but were admitted for one reason or another, or students who are certainly bright enough, but who are very lazy.
Yeah.
Or have got other issues and simply have determined either voluntarily or involuntarily that they will not be able to do the work that's required in order to get the grades that that would serve them well. So I the bottom of the class is, of course, at any of these schools, relatively weak. But even as at an Ivy League school, you have those students who simply don't work. I mean, for instance, the University of Texas is ranked higher than SMU is ranked. They're both good law schools. I had a transfer student.
UT Austin.
Yeah, UT Austin. I had a transfer student who came to SMU. This happened quite a few years ago to spend his last year at SMU as a visiting student. And he was a horrible student. Didn't do any work. When he showed up to class, he was unprepared. And I'm sure I did not do well in my class. And I'd be surprised if he did well in any other class. So I think when you get to the very bottom, you simply have students who are unmotivated for whatever reason. But I think the point to be gleaned from this is that wherever one goes to law school, one's got to kind of sit back and think of, what are my strengths?
Yeah.
How can I go about achieving the goal that I want, whatever that goal is? And sometimes it's hard figuring out what that goal is. And then basically set out a plan to try to effectuate that. And you're not going to effectuate that, sitting in your apartment listening to music. You've got to get out. You've got to meet people. You've got to write articles. You've got to try to speak. You've got to go to bar association meetings. You've got to really spend time also developing clients. Go to your social club, your workout gym, wherever you decide to worship, you go there. You meet people. And you try to develop relationships.
Yeah.
Because that's what's going to give you the flexibility in order to basically generate your career the way that you want.
I wholeheartedly agree in that you should not look at it as an academic exercise. It's not just about knowing the rules. You've got to cultivate yourself, and you've got to engage in practicing the law. And that means engaging with the community, with your profession, and being plugged in, being active, being cognizant of what's going on in the profession and the changes in the society around you. I mean, Bill Murphy, one of my professors at Franklin Pierce, used to say the best lawyers are those that have interests, that are well-rounded, lead balanced lives, and have interests outside the law. But to your point about laziness of students. I mean, this ties into the issue of grade inflation. I mean, from far as I've read, places like Boston University Law School beat Boston College, Dedman at SMU, where you are. It's known that at these schools, you earn your grades. But at the upper echelon law schools, they say at Harvard, for example, you've earned your B, and depending on how much more you want to work beyond that, your grade will only go up. But the feeling is that, okay, at the upper echelon law schools, if you give less than a B, you have to, meet with the dean of students as to why you've downgraded the student, because that can affect their GPA and ability to graduate and job prospects. But the feeling is upper echelon law school, these kids are the best and brightest. They've gotten in. So to the extent their grades don't reflect their full potential, they're not applying themselves. Okay, so they've earned their B. Then we come to the top 14 law schools. And the feeling for the longest time is if you get in there, you're golden, you're set for life. You can take that degree and go anywhere in the country, anywhere in the world, and have a comfortable existence. And for the longest time, there was a lot of truth to that. But I'm also seeing that firms are looking beyond just academic pedigree.
I still do think the grades matter, and I think there is grade inflation all over. I do know that I give higher grades today for the same work than I did 20 years ago.
Real? Okay. Well.
So yes, it happens there as well. So it's really happening at many, many schools, the grade inflation. I do have a funny story. Maybe we can end on this, and that is I have a friend who is teaching at one of those premier schools. And he was a visiting professor, and he gave a student a D, and he got a call from the registrar, and the registrar said, "Professor, we don't give grades like that here at," and mentioned the school, and he said, "You do now," and the student got a D. He was not asked back to visit again. I do, it is true. There is grade inflation. The students, though, the most of the students that I teach are very hardworking. They're very serious. After all, they're paying a lot of money, spending a lot of time, and they're doing the best they can given the challenges they have, the stresses of being in law school, finding a job, and so on. And from what I can see, as far as my viewpoint of legal education in the United States, is that all things considered, the situation is doing very nicely.
One quick last point I want to make. I mean, I recall one of my professors really irked the administration once when they gave everyone a B, and they didn't want that. They wanted the normal bell shape, mound shape distribution of, mostly Bs, some As, some Cs. And he was like, "I didn't feel anyone did C grade work. I thought everyone was at least at the B grade level, but I couldn't give out any." If I gave out A's, that meant I had to give out some C's, and I didn't want to do that. One last quick law school question. It's long been my belief that, look, you go through the three rites of passage. You go through law school, you go through the bar exam, and then there's the practice of law. It often seemed to me that there's disconnects between all three of those legs of the journey. Law school doesn't necessarily have all that much to do with the bar exam, which doesn't necessarily have to do all that much to do with the practice of law. Yet it's still the case that academic law is taught a certain way versus when you encounter those same rules in preparation for the bar exam. In law school, I feel maybe too much time is spent using the Socratic method. Do you see any prospects for change and the fact that now you're starting to see more online law schools get off the ground? I mean, is what can we expect in legal academia in the decades to come?
Well, that's a question I really don't know. All I can really talk about is the way that I teach, though. And the way I teach is a practical perspective, adding hopefully intellectual viewpoints that enables the student to do well in the course if he or she studies and is well organized and prepared, that enables the student to do Well, on that subject matter on the bar exam, basically business enterprise, which is a bar subject, it would enable the student to do that. And then also prepares the student, such as if that student becomes a securities lawyer, my securities law courses helps that student, of course, not know everything about securities law, but certainly provides that student with a strong basis when entering a law firm that he or she is comfortable in undertaking an assignment, of course, with the guidance of a more senior lawyer. That's what my students have told me, although I am viewed as hard. So some students, of course, do avoid me because I do not so much grade wise, but in the coverage of the work that I cover and the analytical issue, the analytical type of teaching that I do. But I like to think that on my faculty that most of the professors teach in that fashion. So I really do not see the disconnect in the same way that you do. On the other hand, going back many years ago when I was a student, I definitely saw that disconnect in some of the classes I took in law school.
Sometimes I do see a fair amount of gamesmanship among students about taking, should I take business associations with this prof rather than that prof? Who's the cakewalk prof? I mean, those games still get played. I guess maybe that's just certain things are inherent to academia. Sir, those were all the questions I had for you. Was there anything else you wanted to say before we ended?
Yes, I'd like to thank you for inviting me on this very impressive podcast. You're having an impressive career yourself. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I very much enjoyed my visit to Hong Kong University a month or two ago. It was my third visit there. Professor Doug Arner and I are friends. In fact, you may or may not know this. He was my former student and was my research assistant at SMU. So we have a good friendship. It's a great university. I'm delighted to have been affiliated there. Hope to come back and visit as soon as I'm invited. Thanks so very much. Happy New Year.
Please do come back, sir. Thanks again. And to our viewers, thank you again for joining us. Until next time.